Ann and I want to just thank everybody so far for the lot of help that you've given us over the last year and a half. I think we've been ViBug members for the last year and a half, and it was nothing short of a godsend when we met Amy Rule and got introduced to this community, because it's really made a big impact for the kind of work we do now. Both of us work for Fidelity Investments. We're kind of on the systems end of things, and we sort of deal in the realm of websites and products. So I don't know if any of you have heard of Fidelity Investments, but it's a large mutual fund company in the U.S. Supposedly, we're the number one provider of workplace retirement savings plans. Some estimates suggest that about 12 million employees in the United States save through Fidelity-administered plan. This, I think Fidelity is typically associated with finance and money management, but we also do a lot of human resources and benefits outsourcing, and actually that part of the company is growing by leaps and bounds, and that also dovetails prominently in with the web channel. And, you know, we have customer assets over $2.5 trillion, et cetera. The web is by far the most dominant channel by which we do business. So as of December of last year, over 94% of our trades occurred online, and those are trades that we get commissions on, so people at Fidelity really like that. We get over 1.5 million contacts a day, and this is just on Fidelity.com, which is our retail site, but we have a whole slew of sites that face customers in one level or another. We get over 95,000 online trades daily, and we have over 6.5 million brokerage accounts, folks that manage their accounts online. And a little overview about Fidelity.com for those of you who might not have been to it. It has about 45,000 pages. It has a lot of information on it. You can manage your account-related information. You can do all kinds of analysis. There's a lot of third-party equity research. You can monitor a watch list if you want to track certain equities but not necessarily invest in them. But it requires a fair degree of familiarity with financial terms and concepts, etc. And it also tends to be happiest in Internet Explorer, but support for Firefox is growing. And we also have a lot more development in Flash occurring. You can understand where we might be concerned about, maintaining a certain level of accessibility.
So our role in the company is we're in the IT side or the technology side of the company, and we work in a group that's basically a usability group. So our jobs primarily, at least in the past, has been to sort of usability test our website. Any new functionality that's coming up, we have users come in, we watch them use our products, we watch them complete tasks, and that helps us design better pages, and whatever feedback we get, we incorporate that. As you know, the worldwide population, U.S. population, is aging, and those retiring baby boomers are worth a lot of money. The company, 4 or 5 years ago, made a strategic decision to start learning more about these users, and so from our end, in our side of the company, we started working a lot with older users. And the reason we're talking about this is this is really what led us into start thinking more broadly about just not older users or younger users, just all users, universal usability. So it really was our first entry into thinking about just not just designing for the average user, but for all users, considering all abilities.
So basically, we have a set of people come in individually and interact with whatever product we're evaluating, and they'll step through a set of tasks or something, and while they're doing so, they'll talk out loud and let us know what they're looking for, what they're finding, what they're not finding, likes, dislikes, and making suggestions for improvement. And all the while, we're taking metrics or subjective or qualitative data, whatever the study at that point might be calling for. But our job really is to take whatever suggestions folks recommend or issues that we can identify that the participants themselves might not readily be able to articulate, and then fold those suggestions back into subsequent iterations of whatever product we're testing. What we've learned in looking at the special requirements of the baby boom, a lot of them may be, those on the older end, maybe retired before the web really took hold in the workplace. So we've noticed that they tend to be a little less familiar with some web conventions, maybe. We've seen behavior that we call cautious clicking, positioning their pointer over a link and then debating whether or not they want to click on it. Don't want to go down the wrong road, or maybe less confident in their ability to recover and, go back to the home page, etc. Also issues with understanding terminology online, login. We asked someone to go back home once, and she started packing up her belongings to leave. So it's that sort of bridge that we're trying to cross. We found that there were ways, design solutions were designed specifically to address the needs of the older demographic, but actually ended up helping others as well. And that's sort of the universal design end of the story.
Well, we started thinking about the older population, and we started noticing they had a lot of visual issues. And then that led us to start thinking about, designing to support a broad range of low vision issues. And then we started thinking about blindness as well, and other, you know, things as well. Everyone should be, we really do feel everyone should be to come to our site and access the web and do whatever they need on our site with easily, and that's our goal, and we have a long way to go, but, you know, it's a good effort.
Accessibility also sort of dovetails nicely into issues of searchability, so if your site is architected properly, it'll enable all users of your site to search more effectively. It also dovetails with code compliance. So any systems or websites that we might be developing internally, if they're fully accessible, then chances are they'll be much more able to interface with other technologies or other kinds of devices that may be coming down the pike. Just to backtrack a little bit and talk about some of the research we did with older adults. You know, we talked about less familiarity with some of the web conventions, the cautious clicking. There's also issues with Windows management, recognizing links, and they also, well, most of you that we've seen in the lab and many others that we also see in the lab when we test with employees, let's say, scan pages readily. They don't, you know, spend a lot of time. They're looking quickly for the links or any interactive components that will take them to the information that they need. Quite the contrary with older users, they read absolutely everything that's on the page because they want to be very careful not to miss anything. And they figure that someone has gone to the trouble to provide them important information and they don't want to miss it. So we have, you know, metrics on average clicks per minute, and you know, those who are under 55 had, you know, on average 3.28 clicks, and those who were older had about 2.29. So they're averaging just under a click a minute less than their younger counterparts.
Some of the things we saw older folks do, doing things like when you have a bulleted list, instead of clicking on the link, they'd click on the bullet, which wasn't hot because it looked like a button.
So some of the things we did to address that were we made bullets, if they were part of a list of links and they were bulleted, then we make the bullets also hot. The bullets that corresponded to each link were also hot. The example we use for universal design is that our building, it was technically accessible. This is our building downtown at 245 Summer. For a long time, it had stairs leading up to the front, and there was a wheelchair ramp in the back, you know, technically accessible. But then they gutted the lobby and redid the facade, etc. And so now, instead of stairs, there's a gentle sloping incline that leads up to the front door. And not only is it aesthetically pleasing, it helps people in wheelchairs, it helps delivery people, it helps me when I'm tired and, you know, it's Monday morning. So that's kind of the, you know, advancing one single design solution that works well for everybody. And there are often unintended ways in which people benefit. Many folks, especially those that don't feel particularly web savvy, would much rather interact with a human, especially when it comes to dealing with financial issues. So that was part of a study where we had 69 people from, you know, all walks of life and all different ages. We put them into different age categories and had them complete tasks on Fidelity.com. Things like find a particular, how well a particular fund is doing, or move money from one fund to another.
And they worked on a prototype of our site. So a lot of times we build out these prototypes of Fidelity. We envision like, oh, we can make Fidelity better if we did this or that. So we do that, whatever it is, and then we bring people in and we test them to see if our thoughts or our design solutions improve their experience on Fidelity. So for this one, we thought, you know, for the older folks, it was geared towards them primarily at first. If we could give them more information about what would happen when they clicked a link, they might actually be able to do better on our site. So when they moused over a link, a pop-up window would display if they had visual help on, and it would tell them more information about what would happen when they clicked on that link. We also had recorded audio files because we know a lot of older folks like had trouble scanning and they couldn't see very well. So we had recorded audio files that would also read that information to them and tell them more about that link. So we're going to demo that for you now. So this is a demo of Fidelity.com. But whenever someone mouses over a link, you get both a visual pop-up with information and you hear a recorded audio file. See if you can guess which one of us it is. And this is what we did the study on. So,
okay. So,
research menu. Click this menu to see the variety of research options that Fidelity provides you. Charitable gift fund. Click this link to learn more about Fidelity's charitable gift fund and giving account. A way of simplifying the administration of your charitable donations.
And it also worked on things that weren't necessarily links, but we have a market update graph on our homepage.
Market update graph. On trading days, this graph shows the hourly values of today's Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Margie recorded 615 separate audio files for the demo that we created.
The other thing that we offered, so the visual help and the audio help were things that you could have either on simultaneously or, you know, one or the other. In addition, we offered font scalability features, and this is right on the interface, so it was right there on the upper right-hand corner, so folks could click on, you know, whatever font size they wanted. If you moused over a link and you had chosen visual help that would give you that pop-up, the text would also respond to the setting that you had selected for the font.
So the font could get pretty big. We didn't offer other features at this time, but we, you know, a lot of people did use it, and it was really our first effort, and this is probably maybe 3 or 4 years ago, to consider, you know, giving more flexibility in our interface. But in general, I think people preferred the visual help.
We let them choose which conditions they went into. We didn't force them into. We did have a control group that had no conditions, even though we told them what we were doing. By far, people chose the visual help more than, I mean, and we asked them why, and they said, well, the web is a visual medium, and so I want to leverage all the visual information that I can. Financial expertise is strongly correlated to performance across all age groups. So one of the things that visual help did was allowed people that might not be very familiar with financial terms and concepts to get a better sense for where they might go to look for something specific. So when we, let's say, started doing our low vision study, we got all kinds of people with contacts and glasses, you know, who maybe had, you know, were myopic, mildly so, who wanted to participate. And so we had, mistakenly, a couple younger folks sneaked through who wore glasses, but they were helped dramatically by the visual help because it floated more information to the top for them. They were research subjects like anyone else. They just happened to not be the ones we were targeting at that point. But that's a sort of unintended gain that we got from the visual help. It was something that was intended to address people with sort of vision issues, but it ended up helping people with sort of financial expertise issues. So that's a literacy and a kind of accessibility all its own. We have ways of gauging financial expertise when folks come into the lab. We have a little quiz, 18 question, you know, multiple choice. It says, if you know, like, questions like, if you buy a company stock, A, you own part of the company, B, you've lent money to the company, C, you're liable for the company's debts, D, the company will return your original investment to you with interest, E, don't know or not sure. It's that sort of thing that we then tally in the background. And it's not to test people. It's just to get a sense of sort of what they might be familiar with before coming to a site like ours.
What we found in terms of the main study was that for people who used help who were 65 years or older, they completed 69% of their tasks with the help, but only 38% of their tasks without the help. So the help greatly improved their performance. For people under the age of 65, with the help, they completed 67% of their tasks, and without the help, they completed 71%. So they actually did better without the help. Older users in general tend to have much more difficulty on our site. They complete their tasks, much fewer of them successfully, and they take longer to do it. So the help helped them, and it didn't really hurt the younger users, and it also helped people with low financial expertise. So it was the first time, you know, we in the field knew about universal design, and it sounds like a great principle, do one thing for everyone and it's great for everyone, but we actually saw it in the lab. It was a good finding that we speak about a lot still.
So those who are 65 and older, 86% of them chose some larger font size. Those who are 50 to 64, 71% of them chose to increase font magnification. 35 to 49-year-olds, only 9% chose them, larger font sizes, and we sort of joke that they're maybe in denial. But of the age group of 20 to 34-year-olds, 25% chose larger font scalability options.
And there's a lot of small text on our site. I mean, you can imagine a lot of data tables with statistics about a font's performance or whatever. So a lot of that's really small. So a lot of people just would naturally like the text bigger if they're looking through those tables.
Audio and visual help improve the user experience for not just older users, but also those with lower financial expertise, as we said. And even when you're not necessarily helping improve people's performance over time on your site, improving the sort of subjective overall experience, that's really important, especially in our industry where trust and credibility are so crucial. The next study after that, we knew we wanted to work with folks that had some degree of vision issues that might be able to give us some good feedback on the kinds of features that we are providing at the interface level. The demographic we wanted to work with were those who had a visual impairment, who may not yet use adaptive technology, and that would help us learn about the range of issues that we were able to start experimenting with at that point. So in the second version of the help study, basically, we had 13 folks with different kinds of vision impairments come in and basically interact with the same prototype that had visual and audio help. It had text scalability features as well, only we offered more text scalability features and a reverse contrast option. Even at 4x, which was at the largest font size that we offered, there was still no horizontal scrolling. You know, we worked to make the colors within the reverse contrast version sort of pop well for folks. Some takeaways from the work with the few folks who helped us with the low vision study. First and foremost, that there are many different definitions of low vision. We also learned about the difference between seeing things on print versus projected text and how there can be a real difference for some folks along those lines. One of the things we did was we put our tasks on a laptop so people coming in could read them. We also had a larger screen. It was a 27-inch monitor, so folks could read their tasks that way or work with forms, etc. We had someone come in and work with ZoomText who had the reader feature as well. And so he could listen to the links and ZoomText, but that was part of the issue, is that there was sometimes information overload. And a lot of the things within the prototype at this juncture worked only on mouseover, which was, you know, this is our sort of first stage foray into accessibility. So we didn't, you know, we weren't quite ready to support tabbing around a page, which is naturally something we'd include now. We asked some folks to rate their experiences with the site. We had them do tasks on the prototype that offered font scalability features and the reverse contrast and the audio and visual help. And then we had them do tasks on livefidelity.com. And things were very different, as you can imagine. We had them rate their feelings of effectiveness, efficiency, and comfort before interacting with both sites, and we had statistically significant differences from one to the other. So folks far preferred the one that offered the various sort of adaptive features to the live site. Some of the things we learned is that we could probably even offer greater degrees of magnification. Calling out or literally highlighting the links also helped folks, and that was something that we added subsequently. You know, we hadn't even thought to consider bigger mouse icons, things of that nature. Folks working with intense levels of magnification often had trouble maintaining context or their sense of where they were within the site or with on a particular page. So that was stuff that we then tried to address with focus groups, which a good number of you participated in.
So then we had two focus groups. I think we had 11 in one and 14 in another,
something like that. This was last April. Yeah, so we'd seen folks spend a lot of time and effort scanning content on both the prototype and the live site in the lab, and there were issues of fatigue and so forth, so we wanted to try to address that. Some people had made suggestions about overviews of the site.
The focus groups, we had two 90-minute focus groups. Some people in the focus groups were blind, and some people had low vision or were visually impaired. And we had three laptops there. We had JAWS and ZoomText and WindowEyes loaded on them, and we would ask folks to listen to some of these pages that we had created with overviews, and we had done it in different ways, and then just engage in a group discussion about how it worked, how it didn't, how it could be done differently. I think we ended up having...
seven who worked with some screen reader, and nine who worked with ZoomText or some magnifier. There were three different approaches to the overview issue. First, we had people interact with just straight ahead fidelity.com as a baseline, as a point of comparison with no overviews. And then a version that provided one big overview that gave information about the page, the title of the page. It gave you kind of a brief overview of what you could do there. It listed access keys that you could utilize on the page. It told you a little bit about the navigation and sort of what the main buckets were, and a little bit about the page structure, sort of how the major components were laid out. Then there was another overview version that was, instead of being a long overview, was sort of segmented into shorter chapters. So it had basically the same information that the longer overview had, but it was just segmented out. And the way in which you accessed the overviews was different. So we had, each version had alt text. There was like an invisible GIF. It was one by one invisible GIF, an invisible image at the top of the page that screen reader users could interact with. And then for those who were mouse driven, we had buttons, either for the large overview or for the chaptered overviews, there were buttons, a set of buttons for each to play and stop.
And for the long overview, for the screen reader users, we use a long description tag, if you're familiar with that, because there is a limit as to how much text you can put on an alt text. Our long descriptions were long. This is an example of a page that has two things. One, there are visible buttons for someone using a magnifier, anyone, to play and stop an overview. And then also we implemented the long, I think this is a long overview, on a long description tag, but I think we'll just play this with the button. But they're both the same.
Fidelity.com, the website for Fidelity Investments. This is the homepage. Fidelity.com lets you open new or manage existing investment accounts. You can also research mutual funds, stocks, or bonds that you may wish to invest in, and find news related to how the market or specific companies are doing. Some access keys that can help you navigate the homepage are, to return to the homepage from anywhere on this site, press Alt-H. To go to a page that will allow you to open a new account, press Alt-O. To go to the customer service page, press Alt-C. To search this site, press Alt-S to get a stock or mutual fund quote, press Alt-Q. To play a voice-recorded overview of this or any page on the site, press Alt-P. To stop a voice-recorded overview of this or any page, press Alt-X. The main navigation menu that runs along the top of the homepage is consistent across every page on the site. The navigation contains six main categories: accounts and trade, research, retirement and guidance, investment products, your profile, and customer service.
We'll stop it there. But basically, I went on
and on. It goes on and on.
And this was all, you know, we thought, oh, great, we're going to provide helpful information. But we learned quickly that few people wanted to wade through all this sort of information up front.
So the chaptered overviews was exactly the same information, but it was more segmented out. So you could play just the introduction. You could play just a brief page, not that brief, but not brief enough, but a page overview. You could play something that just told you about the access keys.
So here we had them segmented out. There were individual play and stop buttons for both introduction, page overview, access keys, navigation, and page structure. So if you wanted to hear about the page structure.
The top of Fidelity's homepage has a header that exists across the top of each page on this site. The header contains an image of Fidelity's logo, which links back to the homepage, a link to open accounts, a link for customer service, as well as a site search and a quotes lookup functionality. The main navigation is just beneath the header and runs across the page from left to right. For more specific information on the contents of the main navigation, press Alt 5. The body of the page below the navigation is sectioned into three columns. The column on the left features a login box at the top, followed by a link below that allows you to customize Fidelity's homepage, and then a list of links that take you to separate Fidelity-related websites.
So anyway.
For me, that is a very visual description. I don't care about that.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I don't care about all that visual information.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's definitely
it's a great
true.
Point.
We've heard two different things. We've heard from some people that they do want to have an idea, especially if they have some visual ability left, you know, where those things are. Even if they don't, some people just like the visual description. But then we did hear that a lot of people have just gotten their way.
You know, some folks might be working with people who are sighted, and then that would give them sort of a common ground. But, yeah, it's a definite, we've heard that a lot, actually.
If I was going to do tech support, I'd sure want that, because a lot of people do have some vision. It is really variable, because actually where the information is on the page is irrelevant, because the screen reader will change the presentation anyway.
Right.
We were actually down in Florida a couple times this winter working with retirees, and we heard a fair number of them want sort of tutorial-esque features on pages, especially on our site. Video, anything assistive that they could get their hands on to sort of better leverage the kind of information that Fidelity offers. We heard time and time again, we know you have a really rich site, lots of functionality, but I don't know where to begin to start accessing it. We asked folks to rate the perceived ease of access and the perceived ease of use with each of those approaches, and also how confident they felt with each of those three versions. LiveFidelity.com fared less well. Next was the large, you know, holistic overview that was sort of in the middle, and then the segmented overview definitely fared the best. And those differences were actually statistically significant. There was also the issue of access keys, which over time we've found people seem to really like them, but we don't necessarily need to offer 100 of them up front. We've heard feedback a lot over the year that maybe just a crux few, like maybe one for home, one for contact information, one for search, are what most people seem to wanna see. Well, that brings us to the study that we did last summer, which, again, many of you took part in. And this is where we took the overviews, the idea of overviews and shorter overviews, and tried to put them on every page across a site where it was a prototype. So it was sort of meant to be Fidelity.com with these overviews implemented across each page. We had some questions going into it, too. I mean, we've all heard about Section 508 and so forth. There are some areas of our company that interface with government, but we're by no means responsible for being Section 508 compliant across all of our products. But it was something we wanted to look at, and we wanted to see, okay, let's say you're 508 compliant, how does that really impact ease of use? Is technical accessibility usability? We had, you know, one version that contained no overviews and one version that contained overviews, and the idea was to bring people in. Again, we were still focusing on JAWS users just because that's where we started to gain a little bit of expertise in a sea of not knowing. We brought them in to compare, and we had a known issue with our top nav that there, you know, it could be more accessible. So we basically broke out all of the links available within the top nav and put them sort of in a sitemap-like homepage. So that was good on one level because it made things more accessible up front, but it also meant people had to deal with 86 links on the homepage.
That site was 508 compliant, basically.
Yeah.
That version was Fidelity.com, but 508 compliant, and with a sitemap like homepage.
And then the second version looked identical to the sighted user, only it had these overviews embedded. They were not visible to the sighted user. They were embedded on an invisible image at the top of each page. We also added HTML headings so people could parse data accordingly, and we added access keys. So, and again, the overviews were just to give people a gestalt, you know, an overall sense for the page and what you could do. The overviews were not chaptered, and their express purpose was to describe whether or not the page was transactional or informational, and then very briefly the key functionality or content that was available on each page. It was at the top, so it was possibly one of the first things users saw as they were arrowing or tabbing.
Do you want to hear that in JAWS or no?
Yeah.
So this is a prototype.
Fidelity.com navigation menu. This page link graphic skip the end of navigation alt plus 2. Welcome John Smith. Link graphic index nav file slash fiddly logo. Link home.
That's the non-overview version.
Okay, so here we go.
Link graphic press alt 4. For sitemap, press alt 3. For information on contacting Fidelity, press alt 4. To log in or log out, press alt 5. To skip to the main content. Link graphic and access a brief overview of the page, press alt O, alt plus X.
Although,
the home page lists the main categories of information and links for the site. To navigate the site, use the links on this page, which are divided into the following six categories: accounts and trade, research, retirement and guidance, investment products, your profile, customer service, and your list of global access keys. Press Alt plus X. Alt plus O link graphic. Alt X navigation. The following are a list of seven access keys you can use at any point in the site. To return to the home page, press Alt 1. For an overview of the site, press Alt 2. For sitemap, press Alt 3. For information on contacting Fidelity, press Alt 4. To log in or log out, press Alt 5. To skip to the main content and access a brief overview of the page, press Alt O, Alt plus X link graphic.
So Margis is, you know, using shortcut keys like that you're hearing to access the different types of overview information that we had there. A lot of people like them. I remember Jeanette, though, you know, every time you went to a page, you'd get that. She started getting really tired of hearing those access keys. Aside from the overviews, they all had HTML headings and access keys on the page. So we looked at that site versus one without those features to see if it would make a difference in people's performance and if they liked it or if they didn't, their subjective ratings, all those different types of things.
Oh, and the other thing that I don't know if we mentioned is in implementing the access keys, we actually put a call in via the browser title bar. So when the page loaded, it would say, well, Fidelity Investments, screen reader users can press Alt plus X for a list of access keys. And then you get that same list that you heard. And there's a lot of controversy still over, you know, how to offer access keys. You know, whether or not you're offering them is one issue, but also communicating what those are is another. So we thought we'd...
One thing I would suggest is that whenever possible, and frankly, WindUIs does a much better job of this than JAWS, is they don't replicate anything you can do with Windows. So the same thing. Anything you can do with the web already using standard Internet Explorer keys or screen reader keys, you don't need to replicate by creating an access key, an additional access key. What you want your access keys for are specifically for things that we wouldn't immediately be able to get to quickly. But when you create access keys for things that already have keys associated with them, it really drastically complicates the learning curve.
Yes, it does.
One of the things that's problematic for Windows that I've seen a lot of people struggle with is that, as everybody knows, there are five ways to do things in Windows. And when you're trying to learn how to manage all of this complex information, most people want to learn one way, at least initially, since they know that way. So it can get very confusing if they've been learning Windows keystroke navigation or IE keystroke navigation or screen reader navigation, and then they've got another set of keystrokes, some of which do the exact same things as things they're just trying to learn to use. If I'm learning a program or learning something, give me Braille.
Absolutely. Even if Fidelity ends up saying, to those of you who are interested in using our website, we have reference cards, we have something we can send you that'll give you these things. I don't know. I mean, that's not quite what you guys are trying to do. Right?
Why not have a Braille tips card? One of the issues with the way we did these overviews really caused conceptual issues for folks with screen readers. So we put all this alt text on an image, and they didn't expect that. So what would happen, like when people would, you go to a trade screen, it would say, this is a trade screen where you can perform a trade, so forth. And then for the people that use Control Find, the Control Find feature in JAWS would find that text. So if they were looking to do a task with trade, they'd search on the word trade, and it would bring them to the overview, which was just alt text. And they would be really confused because it wasn't clear to anyone that wasn't visible text on the screen. So it was really a conceptual issue, and we were trying to help folks, but there are different ways to do it than using alt text these days with style sheets, where you can just put text that no one sees, but it's not on a, you know, on an image. Everyone can benefit from the page overviews, at least when they're first time or new users. So first of all, page overviews are good for everyone, but not always. You should be able to toggle them on and off, and they should be visible for everyone, and so that everyone gets the same, you know, access to them.
You know, we had 22 folks come in and interact with both version 1 and version 2. That was the more souped-up version. And before we also had sort of this issue of how to gauge not only web expertise, but JAWS expertise, because the two seem to really go together. So we asked people beforehand sort of the length of time using JAWS, frequency of use, the range of activities they did online, you know, do they purchase things, they download things, their comfort with or ability to customize JAWS. People are coming from their homes to work with JAWS in our lab. We want to make sure that they have, you know, the time they need to sort of configure it to their needs, but not everybody knows how to do that necessarily, so that was something we were looking at as well.
And when we do empirical studies, we want to control everything we can so that if we see a difference between performance on version 1 versus version 2, we know it's because of the things we added, not just because the people in version 2 were highly technical JAWS users. So we try to control for that, and we need to measure for it. Because you can imagine coming to our site, your level of JAWS expertise, your level of web expertise, and your level of financial expertise are all going to factor in to how well you're going to do. Mm-hmm. So we try to control for all those things so that if we see an improvement in performance, we know it's because of the overviews or the access keys or whatever.
Yeah, we tried to ensure that the task sets that people did on version 1 and 2 were equivalent. We switched the order in which the task set was basically the same, so people did tasks 1 through 5 on one version and then 6 through 10 on another, but then we alternated the order in which people saw the different versions. And, you know, we looked at click paths and how deep down an answer was found and tried to make the both sets equivalent, basically. So examples were, you know, you want to buy 100 shares of Google stock in this particular account, go about doing that. And one of the things we also did preliminarily to people attempting tasks was engage them in a little bit of discussion. Want to find out about maybe the origin of vision loss or the way in which folks had learned the web, whether they'd primarily learned it, whether they'd first learned it visually and, you know, then maybe lost vision, or had they sort of, you know, grown up blind and so forth, and therefore, you know, JAWS was really the only way that they had ever conceptualized it. So we wanted to try to kind of get at those issues. It seems like for the most part, those that, you know, were blind since birth tend to conceptualize the web as linear. You know, no surprise there. But for us, that was kind of an aha. Versus those that had some vision earlier on in life, had maybe a better sense for what a three-column layout would be, or maybe cared more about the physical layout of things. And we talked about likes and dislikes and so forth, and learned all about improper form labels and so forth, and that was stuff that we tried to account for in the prototypes as well.
What kinds of response do you get when you present this kind of information to developers and designers?
Well, I will say that in presenting to upper-level management that issues like lawsuit and compliance resonate. So that's kind of the low road, but that is a way, and that sort of we talk about the legal climate, etc. And we also did sort of quick and dirty competitive assessment of what our pages in front of the login and how accessible they were versus those of many of our competitors. And that also, I mean, Fidelity was somewhere in the middle, just of the sample that we selected. Traditionally, people at the company are not necessarily happy with being somewhere in the middle. They want to, you know, advance things. But in terms of designers and developers, we've been pretty fortunate, and I think the climate is helping us. People are actually being really thoughtful about accessibility. It wasn't always the case, certainly. But I think bringing people into the lab definitely significantly impacted the level of interest that we had.
And we secretly rejoiced with like Target.com getting sued. It's always good for us, and we don't want to see necessarily suits, but it actually does. You know, unfortunately, we tailor our message to who we're presenting to, and for management, they're thinking about that. But the developers and designers tend to be challenged by it. I think the one issue that I keep seeing now that I think you're asking is sometimes there's a square off with the visual designers. So they feel like, well, designing for a screen reader user means you can't make your site look pretty. I can't use images. I can't use, you know, if I have to make high contrast, like it's not just screen reader. I want to use softer tones, you know, that kind of thing. So the developers attend, you know, if you put a challenge to them, like can you do this and can you do this accessibly, they're pretty challenged. And as we said, like designing for wireless handheld devices is good design for, what's good design for wireless is good design for screen readers. It's just clean, compliant code.
So part of the issue is that you have these guidelines that will say something like, ensure that dynamic content is communicated basically when it changes. And so a developer or designer will look at that and they're like, okay, what does that mean? Like, give me a checklist. The problem is that the guidelines, there's plenty of room for interpretation. And they give you techniques on how to do some of these things, but it's just not enough. So, you know, basically what we get from developers and designers is, I want to do it. I know how to code. Tell me, what does it mean to make something accessible? It's just not clearly defined for anyone.
And since the first version was released in 99, and technology has changed quite a bit since then, I mean, we have all all this, you know, flash and interactive, highly interactive stuff that happens on the client side. So a lot of those don't necessarily map very well to what's currently sort of in the space.
And the one thing we have to remember is that not users are not necessarily designers. So if we say to you, how should we design this? We'd all have different answers. So that's why it's just important just to watch people do it. Because then you're just getting information, you're watching and how they're doing something. Then it's our job to sort of take that information and translate it into design changes. Compliant code is at least halfway there, or more.
Yeah, HTML is pretty much on its way out, and it's all XML now, which is based on compliance.
But, you know, we have so many different opinions. Like, one of the challenges we've been facing recently with the upper manager is, in his view, it's just about alt text. It's simple. You know, there are programs that scan to tell you if there's a missing alt tag. Scan the site and, you know, put in alt text. It's not rocket science, is what we've been told. But it's a lot more than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just a matter of educating people, and unfortunately there are no definitive answers. Especially with a site like Fidelity, there's just a lot of challenges because a lot of the content is dynamic. It's being generated as you enter information. It's different for everyone. So, you know, there's just, I think that people are starting to listen, and we're definitely seeing, in our company, we have a lot of interest. No one used to ask us or care what alt text needed to be, but now we get 70 emails a day asking us very granular questions about what should the alt text be, how should we do this, and that's good. We have style guides and processes within Fidelity. The organization we work in is Fidelity eBusiness Design, so we own the design for all customer-facing sites. We also have a style guide and template process. So most of what we're doing is being applied globally. But Margie and I can't answer all the questions for all the developers and designers in Fidelity. We believe it's one of the things we're struggling with is how do you incorporate accessibility into your corporate structure? Is it with a few people who lead that, or does every person in development and design own a piece of the picture? We think it's every person owns a piece of the picture. All those people want to know exactly what that means for them.
Yeah.
We actually have 8 checklists that we have for Fidelity eBusiness Design, one for a visual designer, one for information architect person. I mean, this is all more than you probably need to know. But that's how we envision it working. And, you know, we just haven't gotten there yet. It's a new initiative. It is supposed to be corporate-wide. But, you know, we have to sort of chart that out. One company that we've talked to that's amazing is IBM. They have 23 million customer-facing pages, and they are probably like at 97% compliance with WCAG Priority 1 guidelines. They have an amazing process. Their person who leads their accessibility initiative is high up in the company. He's blind. His name is Matt King. And they have software programs that actually go out and scan every single one of their pages and look for the types of things you can check for programmatically. And they have an amazing process. And that's where, you know, the more we can work and learn from them, the better we can do, because we're also a big company and it's hard to do.
And their structure is such that whoever is the owner of that page that it has some sort of infraction gets an automatic email, you know, sort of itemizing what it is and notifying them that they need to take part in fixing it. But it's a good question, because we can be on the design side, we can be sort of as accessibility savvy as we want, but the second those specs are handed over to development and QA, it can become a different story, because so maybe you have your alt text that someone from editorial has written, but it means that a developer has to go in and put it in properly, and someone from QA has to check it. So it does have to sort of be baked in to our corporate structure.
Accessibility practices have been at Fidelity for a couple of years, and so there's a table summary attribute that actually says insert accessibility text here, and someone's supposed to do that, and you can actually go out live on our site and get that still, because it's been dropped along the process. You'll actually come to a table summary and it's going to say insert accessibility text here. Now what's happening is customers of ours are asking us, what is your level of compliance before they want to do business with us? This is the thing that makes me laugh. Fidelity, I just got a request yesterday saying, take a look, we want to do business with this vendor. So, you know, like, we have these sites, and then we pull in a lot of information from other sites. And they said, these are their accessibility guidelines. Are they up to par with Fidelity? Oh, my gosh, they were so much better than our guidelines. they met all Priority 1, they 2 Priority 2 they missed, and, like, 2 Priority 3 they missed. So Fidelity is asking vendors, like, we want this compliance, you know, but they're not even doing it themselves. But I think that it's going to be a question that's going to be more asked more frequently, you know, and there's actually been talk within Fidelity. IBM is doing it as well, and they're also a customer of ours. You know, we're in trouble if people start asking this, or we're not in trouble, we'll be even busier than ever when people start giving us requirements for, you know, accessibility of vendors.
So just to close the sort of the ribbon on the overview study is that it did actually improve task success a little bit, not statistically significant or anything, and it also increased the average time that folks tended to spend on their tasks with if they were using the version with the overviews rather than not. Mm-hmm. And we think that's because people were kind of listening to them, fooling around with the access keys maybe, or perhaps searching and getting lost somewhere within all the text that was within the long description. And the emotional ratings were higher as well for the overview version, but not in any dramatic way that we were anticipating. So we just sort of interpret it like that there's more work to be done. We were talking, and we had an opportunity to see 22 people work with JAWS in different ways, many of them similar, but we were amazed at the discrepancies often, or the different kinds of strategies folks employed when navigating both of the sites. So, for instance, there was a husband and wife team that came in on different days, both of them, I think, blind since birth. They each had their own desktop in their home, different, you know, own headsets, etc., and they used radically different strategies. I mean, it was amazing. He was, you know, to be sure, more technical. He'd written scripts for JAWS to, you know, extend its capabilities, etc., and she was more of a linguist, etc. But it was amazing that they hadn't had, you know, shared more of their tricks and tips of the trade and so forth. So we thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if we could look at performance measures and then correlate them with navigation strategies?
We had this strong sense that, like, some people were more effective than others,
yeah.
And it was because of the way they were using JAWS. And we wanted to, like, try to figure that out in a technical way. And we also found that we were amazed. Like, by the end, we just wanted to start telling people these things we were learning. Like, after watching 22 people use JAWS on 8 or 16 tasks or whatever,
yeah.
we learned JAWS really well. Like, people would start jumping mysteriously from paragraph to paragraph. It was mysterious to us in a way. And we would be like, hold on, how are you doing that? Like, what is that keystroke? And we would be writing them all down. It's like, wow, like, that's really cool. And so we thought, like, wow, some people have these great strategies and some people don't, and it's probably affecting their experience. So can we go in an empirical way and sort of look at all those keystrokes and figure out, like, well, what really works? What really gets people to where they need to go?
Right, and it was our experience that those that employed, like, a wider range of strategies, you know, when seeking discrete information, tended to be more successful. Those that tended to be more successful also used headings probably early in their process, and they tended to do things like avoid selecting the first link that maybe sounded promising, whether or not it was in links list or just in arrowing down the page. One of the things we let people do is sort of get a sense for each of the sites they were working with before going on to do tasks. To know whatever they wanted to do, however they wanted to handle it. And we found that there were some people that would, like, read the entire page, and there was a lot of content there, so it didn't necessarily aid them in developing a mental model for what was available and how things were structured. So we found that folks that were more successful just were more task-driven right from the get-go. We decided to do some post-hoc analysis and break these navigation strategies up into different kinds of, like, you know, arrowing up and down.
And things we could count.
Yeah.
We wanted to actually go through and count. And by the way, this is our CSUN presentation
right.
that we're giving you right now.
Right, so we looked at access keys, did they use them, yes or no, arrowing up and down, use of the back button, use of control find, form fields, whether or not, you know, you could jump between them or insert F5, calling up a dialogue of them, headings, links list, something we called orientation, which was something of a catch-all, but we saw people often, you know, need to sort of regroup and figure out where they were. Maybe it was refreshing the page or getting a you know, invoking the page title, command,
control home,
yep, to go to the top of the page. We saw also a lot of people close out of the browser and reopen it so that they could be sure they were on the home page. That actually happened quite a bit, especially in between
yeah.
tasks. So we kind of grouped that in with orientation. Then we had, like, a kind of other where we just couldn't determine what was being spoken by JAWS, mm-hmm. so we had a question mark there. Since then, actually, we've gotten a keystroke logger to help automate this process. There's also read all, the extent to which folks did that. Skipping by element, you know, whether it was frame to frame, mm-hmm.
field to field, table to table,
link to link. Tabbing, we looked at the overall time spent on the homepage up front, you know, when getting a sense for what the site offered, and the number of times virtual PC cursor was used.
So those are the things we had
wow.
A lovely intern mostly go back and
yeah.
watch all the sessions over and count every single one of those
wow.
for every single
wow.
task. Whatever people's strategies were, they tended to use them throughout, independent of what the task was. They didn't tend to alter them much. And there's also a different set of strategies for when they first come to a page.
Mm.
You know, first they have to decide, am I on the right page? And then once they've decided if they're on the right page, they might have a different set of strategies that say, okay, now I need to get the information on this page.
Mm.
So there's two different types of strategies there. Basically, the statistical analysis we did was something called a correlation, which is if you take one thing like read all and you look at it statistically to see if it had any sort of relationship to something like task time, you get a statistic that tells you if that was a significant connection connection or not. So it really tells you, like, if things are connected. For example, when it rains outside, there's probably a positive correlation between rain and temperature, or a negative correlation between rain and temperature going down. You know, that there's a connection. It might not be causal.
No, or rain and the extent to which my hair frizzes or something.
Right.
which is definitely positive.
So we took all those things that we, all those things we counted, and we did a bunch of correlations to see if they were connected. So, like, the first one that we found, and these are all statistically significant, was the more that people use read-all mode, the longer they tended to take on their task. That's a very obvious correlation.
There's another one that the more people use links list, the less well they tended to do in terms of task completion.
Which is a really surprising one.
It struck us that those that tended to feel less savvy, both in terms of web and or JAWS, tended to use links list over and over and over as the primary strategy. Secondary, exactly.
Right.
Like, it was
right.
almost their one trick in their bag of tricks.
So the more they used control find, interestingly, the lower their task completion tended to be.
The higher their JAWS expertise was. So we asked them, you know, how long they'd been working with JAWS, how often they were working with JAWS, the kinds of things they did, and we kind of bundled that up into one score. So the higher that score was in terms of JAWS expertise, the more likely they were to use headings.
The more they used headings, the more likely they were to use other skipping commands like form field to form field or link to link.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So performance. So what we're going to talk about is performance correlations, the types of things we saw that were correlated to performance. So performance to us means it's a combined measure. It means the faster you did a task, and the more you did successfully, the higher your performance. So what we found, and some of these are obvious, is that the higher someone's level of web expertise, the higher their performance was. The more they used headings, the better their performance was. The less time they spent on the home page, the higher their performance. Some people would spend 6 minutes listening to the home page.
86 links.
Yeah, 86 links. It was a lot, and I think that just they had so much cognitive overload that when they went to start doing tasks, it hurt them.
Performance was negatively impacted by the extent to which they read all, which is kind of dovetails with the time on homepage, probably. And
the links list, which we already said.
Right. We took all this data, and to kind of help us get our heads around it, we came up with a model. We wanted to sort of parse these out into sort of interaction styles, a few key personas that would kind of, you know, not that we would slavishly place people in, but just to get it, sort of flesh out what the differences were. They are...
The scientist. These are the navigation type JAWS personas that we're attributing. Okay. The scientist, the philosopher.
The librarian, and the gambler. Overall, scientists performed the best out of all of the four groups. They had the lowest task time. They had an average task time of 5 minutes 31 seconds per task. Task success was over 93%, so that's very good. I mean, that definitely outdoes many of the sighted users we have come in. And homepage time was very low. They spent the least amount of time at just over a minute and a half. So they were pretty task-driven right from the get-go. They're very analytical in their approach. They tended to be pretty technical and have a sort of broader framework in which to fit their, you know, understanding of how JAWS works and how a web page might be structured.
So if they came to a page and it had headings, they'd use headings. But if they didn't have headings, they'd move on to another strategy.
That's right. They had lots of things in their bags of tricks that they could use, and they weren't attached to one. They tended to sort of think broadly first and then narrow things down to focus on discrete content last. So they're getting a sense for the hierarchy and the structure, and then they're dealing with bits of content only as a last resort.
And if they did use links list or anything, you know, one of the things Margie brought up is that it can be a critical failure to take the first link that sounds promising in links list. These folks would be looking for a task, they'd hear a link, and they'd say, okay, maybe, but they'd keep going and be very selective, because once you start going down a wrong path, you're adding to your task time, and you can easily get lost. So they would be very, very cautious before they would follow a link.
Next, we had the philosopher, and they tended to be a lot more reflective about things, a little less action-prone. Their task times were very high, at an average of 8 minutes and 52 seconds. Their task success was pretty good, 72%, and their homepage time was also pretty low, just over a minute and 30 seconds as well. But in general, they were pretty goal-oriented like the scientists, but not as technically adept or as willing to skip over content. So they were very patient in finding the answers and problem-solving. You know, they ended up having the longest task times of the four groups, but their success was good. So they're kind of just reflective about what they were hearing, but they lacked that sort of technical expertise that would sort of put them over the, you know, into the scientist.
And they're also very patient. I mean, they would take a while to do some of their tasks, but it was fine by them. As long as they can actually get the information, they were pretty happy with, you know, sticking with it and getting to the information. The scientists is a group that, you know, it's once again, considering our source is ViBug, some people are just so technical. 93% is not a task completion we see with any sighted users coming into our site.
Well, I think Rich runs an adaptive lab at MIT.
Right, yeah, exactly. The librarian is the next one, and the librarian was the type of person who would listen to everything and categorize it and didn't want to skip anything. You know, they'd have a task, but their need was to get the information on the page and listen to things even if it wasn't related to the task. Their task time wasn't quite as high as the philosopher, but their task success was lower at 68%. They did spend a long time on the homepage at 4 minutes and 57 seconds, and that was, again, probably to their detriment. As we saw with the statistics, the correlation showed the longer you spend on the homepage, the lower your task success tends to be. They would error through content a lot. You know, just arrow down through entire pages. That works on some pages when the pages are short and there's not a lot of content, but it didn't work on those pages that were really, really long and had a lot of information.
Yeah, we presented this at CSUN and someone suggested we change the name to Cartographer because they're really like trying to get the total lay of the land and then almost impose their own sense of how the order is. So then we close out with the Gambler, who's totally not systematic. They sort of lack that broader understanding of the technical end of things. And they also aren't very prone to reflection. So they just kind of do stuff and they might shift their strategy and not really have a good sense whether what kind of strategy might be called for in a given instance. They tend to vacillate between the high level, like looking at the structure, and then the granular, like looking for discrete content. And that was sort of random and variable, and their success tended to, you know, depend a lot on luck.
For the Gambler, did you have any way of sensing what mental model they're developing while they're doing that?
It's actually, I think it was the absence of a mental model that
us off. It just struck us that they would be somewhat random. Like, they go into links lists sometimes and immediately take anything that sounded remotely related, easily get off track, and then just get fixated on that page. It's like they didn't have a good mental model. Yeah, and sometimes they stumble upon the answers, but oftentimes they wouldn't. Their task success was 50%.
What percentage of the group fell into each of these?
It's a good question. We get asked that a lot, and I think it was pretty even. Okay. It was about a quarter in each of these. I mean, but actually, I think the Gambler had a couple more members than the other groups.
You think some of this depends on how the web page is written, though? If you could probably design a page that would work best with all of these different blocks.
It's probably true.
That's a great point.
And we also think that some people are gamblers sometimes and philosophers other times, depending on their mood or their time or the task they have.
Or how familiar they are with content.
The one thing we didn't do, but I bet we should, is for the Gambler, it strikes me that they would go to many, many pages. Like, they were very active, like in clicking and jumping around from page to page, and that was also to their detriment because they just would have no information. Basically, we found that people who had a broader range of navigation approaches tended to be more effective. Because, you know, given the content of the site and the different types of pages there are, for example, if headings is the only way you know how to get your tasks on a site, you're in trouble when you get to a site that doesn't have them. So the people who were successful were the ones that could keep falling back onto other strategies when they encountered obstacles on the pages they were on. Those who are successful also were able to scan the page for the overall structure and the hierarchy before they take action on it.
We're really delving down into subsequent levels. And also those who use links lists as like the one trick pony, they were the ones that tended to have trouble on our site. It may be a fine strategy if you know fidelity.com very well and you're a repeat user. But especially I think for people coming to a complex site as first time users, that strategy may not work as well.
And that was interesting to the trainers. You know, they obviously trainers teach people to use links lists and you should use links lists, but you do lose the context of the information. So there are other strategies that can be more helpful. You know, you guys are awesome. We go talk about this stuff and we learn everywhere and we constantly mention ViBug and people are jealous that we have, you know, such a, you know, broad range of folks who are willing to put up with us and work with us and, you know.
It's true. And we have a lot of administrative tasks on our plate now and so forth, and by far the favorite part of our jobs is getting to work with users, and that includes you all. So we definitely hope to have some of you in our lab in the months ahead, and we'll get you more information about an upcoming study that we have. More on that
to
come.
Thank you for all the work you guys do.